Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 85. On this episode of the podcast, we finally talk about Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens. To help me do this, I have brought in a slightly larger panel than normal. We have three huge Star Wars fans, Blaine Grimes, Josh Crabb, and all the way from California, and the More Than One Listen podcast, Josh Long. And for this podcast, we were trying to figure out how exactly we could tackle all the things with so much hype surrounding it, but the hype train is finally pulling into the station, and we ask, how could this film possibly live up to all that hype? Well, it's already broken basically every box office record and has an extremely positive reception from the majority of fans and critics. However, and this is what our show will get into, there is a lot of talk about this film being more of a remake than a sequel. And that gives us a ton of opportunity to talk about story, repetition, and human nature. So, if you listen to this, don't forget to listen to our bonus episode covering listener questions and fan theories and all that kind of stuff that we want to nerd out on. And that'll be a separate piece. But check this one out. It's really great. And make sure that, in general, you're checking out realworldtheology.com, where you'll find ways to get in contact with our panel and other things that we're doing. We have tons of Star Wars and specifically Force Awakens coverage that you will probably really, really enjoy. Follow us on Twitter at Real World Theology. Join our Facebook discussion group, the Real World Theology discussion group, and always look for new episodes. Hopefully you've noticed that this episode's coming out a little bit earlier, so we won't have an episode on the first of the year, just to give this to you guys earlier. So please enjoy it. Rate and review the show. Tell your friends. Let's get more people involved in the conversation. And like I said, it's a really great discussion, and we have a really awesome bonus episode to go with it. But here, this one is episode 85, The Force Awakens and Silencing the Critics. So I'm going to do something to start this podcast that I don't typically do, because typically we would talk our way into it and shoot the bull, et cetera, et cetera. But because we have three extra guests, or three guests besides myself on, I want to make sure we can kind of get into it and we don't lose any of the good stuff by getting ahead of ourselves. Doing that, I'm going to do two things. One is I'm going to point out that we have Josh Long here. All the way from California. We flew him in. You know, that was our budget for the year.
That was very kind of you. First class, too. I appreciate it.
First class for first class. That's really great. I love always meeting someone for the first time, especially when you get to work on them. And there's lots of people who work very closely on this podcast, like Josh or Blaine, who are also on this episode. Blaine, hey.
Hey.
Josh, hey.
Hey, everybody.
We've done lots of podcasts together and we still have not ever met, but the beauty of this is it's making connections. So it's really cool to have Josh Long here in basement studio.
Yeah.
Hopefully not too echoey.
I know.
So that is who is joining me to talk about The Force Awakens. The second thing is that right from the get-go, I want to point out that by the time we release this episode, you should have had enough time to see The Force Awakens. So we're going to talk about everything in The Force Awakens. If you have not seen the movie and you do not want the movie spoiled, don't listen to this episode of the podcast yet. I mean, listen to it, just not yet.
Yes, listen to it later.
If you haven't, you're one of the only people breathing who have not seen The Force Awakens yet because of the enormous amount of money this movie has made. Mm-hmm. So the third thing is that this show has never had a sponsor, but if it did, this show would be brought to you by my wife, who, after I woke up with no voice Monday morning, has done everything in her power, God bless her, to get me enough of a voice to hopefully get through this podcast that I've been looking forward to, that we all have been looking forward to for quite some time. So I just wanted to make sure that I took the time to thank my wife in a public sphere. And if my voice sounds weird
or better, because, I mean, who knows what the opinion is. You have her to thank for this happening on time. With all that said, we're going to dive into The Force Awakens, a movie directed by J.J. Abrams. There was lots of opinions when J.J. Abrams was tabbed to do this, but we brought him to write it along with Lawrence Kasdan, who is no stranger to the Star Wars franchise. We have an entire list of people that I will not get into yet, because I'm sure we'll mention them at some point, of very, very awesome actors and newcomers to the series. And the first thing I want to do is ask you, Josh Long, can you give us an idea of what your expectations were coming into The Force Awakens, mm-hmm. kind of with J.J. Abrams taking over, and then after seeing it, kind of what were your first impressions of the film?
Sure. I feel like there's such a like roller coaster of stuff with this, because like you and I were talking a little bit earlier about how I don't have a lot of connection to a lot of the other big blockbuster properties that are out there, the Marvel stuff, a lot of comic book things that just wasn't a thing for me when I was younger.
Yeah.
Star Wars was. I saw that when I was like probably 6 years old. I saw the first one, and I have loved them ever since. I played the Star Wars customizable card game when I was in high school, so I was way nerdy into all that stuff.
I like how you use was, like totally as in the past.
Now I'm super cool. So I have a lot of a history with it. I waited in line to see when they released the special editions, I waited mm-hmm. in line to see those ones. I saw all the, despite how bad they were, I went and saw all three of the prequels for opening day. And like most people, was super disappointed by those. And so then it's been, I guess the last one came out, what, 2005, right? So it's been mm-hmm. 10 years. We've all had 10 years to like mull over everything. I'll talk about, I think we've gotten more worked up over the years about how bad the prequels yeah. are. I feel like we hate them more than we did every passing year. Mm-hmm. So I guess the first reaction I had to anything, knowing that there were new ones happening, was a little bit of trepidation when it was Disney.
Yeah.
Not that I have like a beef with Disney, but I feel like they do have a little bit of a tendency sometimes to I guess homogenize things.
Yeah.
You know, you get sort of a look that's consistent throughout. And that's one of the problems that I have with a lot of the Marvel movies. Not to go into that, I know that's a whole separate topic, but I guess I didn't want the Star Wars movies to kind of end up being like the Marvel movies, where despite the director, despite the script, they all kind of look the same and feel the same.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, I think we all kind of want the movies to look and feel like the original three. So there's
inner turmoil.
Right, exactly. So I was a little bit worried about that. Also, there's the whole idea of Disney just wanting it as a cash cow, and mm-hmm. you know, we're seeing all the like, I think I've heard so many people talking about how, not necessarily complaining, but talking about how there's Star Wars merchandising on everything, yeah. from like shoes to the craziest one I've seen is a coffee creamer. There's a commercial that had like coffee creamer with Star Wars on it for some reason. That gave me another little bit of a misgiving going in. Is Disney just going to use this for money and do whatever they can just for the money? Then again, J.J. Abrams is someone who I pretty much trust as a filmmaker.
Okay.
I liked what he did with the Star Trek films. I wasn't a Trekkie before, so I don't have have an expectation for that. So I couldn't say whether he fit the...
He was
the,
true to kind of...
Yeah. Right, exactly. But I think he comes more from a sort of school of Steven Spielberg, George Lucas. I think he kind of wants to be today's Steven Spielberg in a lot of ways. And he's not that far off. I mean, even though we've had problems with a lot of his films, I think a lot of them do have some of that spirit the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's not a bad choice. And he's definitely a talented director of science fiction and of action adventure. So I was pretty optimistic when I
on
saw
a scale of 1 to 10 optimism level.
Maybe like a 7.
Okay.
I feel like it was probably a 7 or 8. And my mom was asking me this after I saw the movie. She said, on a scale of 1 to 10, what did you think of Force Awakens? And I said 7 or 8. So it hit about where I expected.
That's good.
I saw the first teaser trailer, I think, and then I after that avoided the other trailers because I didn't want to know too mm-hmm. much, and you know. So, I don't know that I'd say it exceeded, but I think it met the expectations that I had going in with all of this sort of intellectual baggage of Star Wars and Disney and history and all that.
No, I think you actually just kind of peered into my brain and took me step by step through what I was thinking of when I went through it. So let's get some other versions of this. Blaine, same question.
Yeah, I feel kind of the same way. A lot of Josh's stories is pretty similar to mine. Grew up with Star Wars. Was in the theater in 97. You know, there for all the prequels. So they've been a part of my life forever. But I was actually really, really skeptical for a long time about The Force Awakens and about them, you know, rebooting a franchise.
Was it just the reboot or...
I don't really know. I think it was probably, you know, the bad taste that was left in my mouth from the prequels, and just mostly just being scared that it was going to be bad. That didn't stop me from reading all the news that I could find or anything like that. But I was pretty skeptical until the first teaser hit, which was, you know, I guess a little over a year ago now. And
was that a year ago?
I got really excited.
Oh man.
Yeah. Then I started to get really, really excited and my expectations started to grow and grow. And the more I started to read and the more we saw, I was like, you know, this looks and it feels like Star Wars. And, my excitement was through the roof by the time, it, you know, finally hit theaters a few weeks ago.
So on a 1 to 10 optimism scale going into the movie, you were like at 12.
I was probably a solid high 8, pushing 9. Yeah.
All right. So then, the first of the four times you've seen the movie already, you come out of the theater and you thought.
The first time, my first reaction in the theater was something like this. It was like, and then I cried. Not really. But I was super excited. I was super pumped. We saw it. You know, the first showing 7 p.m. on Thursday, the Thursday it came out. And then we actually had tickets for 2 a.m. that I guess is technically Friday morning. We were going to try to get sleep in between then, but I was, you know, so excited talking about this and that. I think I'm probably just now starting to recover from that opening weekend. So, yeah.
So positive. Your reaction was generally positive.
Yes.
Okay. All right. And Josh Crabb.
Yes.
if you were to think that I was going to ask you a question, what do you think that question might be?
How excited or how optimistic was I?
That's what I want to know.
I don't really think that almost anyone needs to know my Star Wars credentials after laboriously slogging through all of my posts leading up to The Force Awakens. I mean, heck, I grew up a Star Wars fan. I'm a little bit more like Josh Long. Like, I never got into, you know, like other comic books. Star Wars was kind of my thing. And so, you know, I got like a huge collection of like the EU books and everything. So the good and the bad. And when you're a kid, you don't really know quite what's good and bad. So you eat up everything and then you go back and read them now and you're like, oh, this is awful. But I mean, there are some good ones. But I mean, as far as my optimism level went into it, ever since they announced the sale to Disney, you know, you knew they were going to make more movies in 2012. So immediately you're starting to anticipate what is going to happen and how the movie's going to be made. And having to endure, you know, just people asking, like, is Admiral Thrawn going to be in this movie? And, like, all this other stuff. And just slogging through all of that, getting past all of that, you know, and then just... There's so much that led up to this besides just the anticipation of the movie. There was like the release of Star Wars Rebels. There was all of the books. There was all the comics. There was all this stuff that really just sort of like heightened. And I think it was encouraging because you got that Disney, especially Star Wars Rebels, you got the feeling that the people that they had on, because I mean, you know, they still had Lucasfilm and everything, like these people and even the newer people they were bringing in understood what Star Wars was all about. And so I was really, really super optimistic for this movie. But leading up to it, you know, I was eating up. I watched all the trailers. I listened to hours and hours and read hours, you know, pages and pages of analysis of the trailers and talking about what's going on and listening to interviews with the casts and, you know, getting the Entertainment Weekly news magazines that had like the little previews and interviews with Abrams and all these other people and getting all of this. But then it's like the week came and I was like, I shut myself out from the internet. I was so terrified to go on and post the Real World Theology articles on Facebook because I knew Facebook would be like, hey, you like Star Wars? What about this? You know, and tell me what it was all about. So I almost got through, but because I'm friends with a certain critic who gets in on Tuesdays, I saw his review like pop up on Facebook and I like practically screamed out loud when I saw it at work on my laptop. But I was super duper excited. My optimism, if Blaine's a 12, I was probably a 12 squared. And
it's not a competition.
It's well, okay.
But if it was, you're winning.
Yes.
But I gladly accept the role of Padawan in this role.
So anyways, you know, and just to follow up on that, you know, I thought it was interesting is my first reaction to the movie. When I saw it for the first time, I didn't really get into it until I saw it the second time, if that makes any sense to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I saw it the first time and there was so much going through my head. There was so much of trying to just take it all in and get used to it because there were, as much as people are saying that there's a lot of similarities between this movie and the original, there was a lot that changed about this movie. And I'm sure I felt probably how I would have if I was 31 now seeing like the Phantom Menace, except I would have walked out and wanted to punch somebody at the end of the Phantom Menace. But, you know, and so I think that second viewing was really helpful to just, you know, I basically sat in the lobby for a half hour, then went back in and waited for the next showing to start. So that was my reaction was very positive and I was very excited leading up to it.
Well, there's a couple things that you mentioned in that, Josh, that actually are interesting to me because you're kind of saying that if, you know, your 31-year-old self would have gone to see The Phantom Menace, you would have wanted to punch something. But I think that the second viewing idea is really important to that because I remember seeing The Phantom Menace and I remember going, this was great. I mean, like, there were times, I was, what, like a senior in high school or something around that time.
Yeah, I was 16 when it came out.
Yeah, so it was one of those things where it's like, oh, there's so much cool in here. Like, I didn't really care about the story. Mm-hmm. I didn't really care about, like, the logical progressions of things or even the kind of moving over of some big ideas to allow for cool things to happen. It was the second time that I saw The Phantom Menace that I realized that I wasn't as excited after I came out the second time. And it's with this film, with The Force Awakens, the first time I saw it, I was so worried that I was not going to like it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had not read any reviews. I just saw that it was like 95% on Rotten Tomatoes. And I said, oh my gosh, I'm not going to like this 95%. And when I got out of the film, I remember one of the first things I said to my wife was, I was like, well, that wasn't a 95% movie. I said, and I think I'm a little disappointed because when I see something that like so many critics universally love, I wanted The Force Awakens to be a five-star movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like I wanted me to be like, had nothing wrong with it.
Sure.
But in reality, I would say it was probably like a 4 out of 5-star movie for me, which to me means that I really enjoyed it and I want to watch it again.
Yeah.
And after I got that whole expectation piece out of the way, getting to go to see it the next night with a different set of friends.
Mm-hmm.
The second time, I didn't have to worry about that expectation up and down, you know, hill valley deal.
Yeah.
And
just waiting for them to screw something.
Yeah,
up.
Waiting for like, you know, always waiting for the other shoe to drop. Basically,
mm-hmm.
I thoroughly enjoyed it the second time. You know, still wasn't a perfect film. Still, you know, had some qualms with how convenient some things were, or that there were some obvious plot holes here and there, but I was like, this is a really enjoyable film that in general feels like the original trilogy. I mean, some of that's the practical effects. Some of it's the keeping the story pretty simple. Mm-hmm. But that leads me to something else that you mentioned, Josh, and that was about how it's been noted by many critics, especially now that it's been out for a couple of days. It seems like the new cool thing to do, the first cool thing to do was like Star Wars. The second cool thing to do is kind of bash it, to be the person who's
well,
like,
of course, I'm if everybody cool. likes yeah. it, then there's got to, yeah, you got to have the go along with the flow. You got to be cooler than that.
So I was telling Josh Long, I was telling you this before that, Blaine and, Josh and I have had a kind of chat room where we have talked about this movie incessantly since like, I think Thursday night or Friday. So I kind of want to hear your opinion about this first. And I would ask you, like, how would you answer critics who say that this film too closely parallels A New Hope? Like, so much so that they are referring to it, I mean, kind of snidely, as a remake mm-hmm. instead of a sequel. A pretty famous or well-known film and theology critic, Ken Moorfield, he suggested that we can debate whether or not The Force Awakens is a good film, but we can't debate whether it's a new film. Kind of suggesting that mm-hmm. it's obviously not new. Mm-hmm. So where would you kind of land on that?
I had the thought, and I'm the only one, I guess, who hasn't seen it more than once yet. I've only seen it once. And I may have seen it more than once by this point if it hadn't been for the fact that I was working on the 17th. I was flying here to North Carolina on the 18th. And so I didn't get to see it until the 20th. Was that Sunday? I saw it Sunday.
Yeah. It wasn't because you didn't have a desire to.
Right. I would have seen it opening day, but I haven't got to yet. And I am planning on seeing it again within the next week probably. So I'm glad to hear that I have an enjoyable second viewing to look forward to. But even in the first viewing, I did come out thinking, like, there are a lot of plot parallels to mm-hmm. A New Hope. In my view, I think that's intentional and I think that's okay. It almost feels a little bit like you could see it as J.J. Abrams trying to cut off Disney's inclination, which I think will eventually
take over.
Well, the inclination, which I think is eventually going to rear its ugly head, which is to remake A New Hope, which I would not want them to do. But knowing Disney in 20 years from now, somebody's going to want to do that. But I feel like this kind of stays that a little bit because it's a little bit of a remake without being a strict remake. You have the person with no parents on a desert planet. Mm-hmm. You have, I guess a bunch of people have talked about this.
Yeah, I was going to say.
You've got a Death Star. You've got a Darth Vader. You've got so many things that are parallels. And I think it's, I don't know, that feels to me like these people paying a little bit of, these current writers paying a little bit of homage and kind of doing that intentionally. And I don't think it's enough of a parroting of the original storyline that it's not interesting or that mm-hmm. it's not fun or that it doesn't have surprises. Although I will say the probably biggest spoiler in the film, when I saw the picture of the table read, the first table read, and I saw mm-hmm. who was there, I said to my wife, I predicted that spoiler.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't think the similarities are a problem. Mm-hmm. It didn't take away from my enjoyment. I saw those similarities, and I'm totally fine with that.
Well, something that's really interesting when this criticism gets levied against Star Wars, or at least as it has in the couple days following,
mm-hmm.
is that we just podcasted recently on Creed. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if you had a chance to see Creed, but
I haven't yet.
People talked about the best thing about Creed was that it went back to the original formula of Rocky and basically retold the Rocky story from a new character's perspective.
Sure.
So I'm trying to figure out where in the critical universe or how many things that you have to do different when it's awesome to go back to the original formula, or apparently sometimes it's not cool to go back to the original formula at all.
Yeah.
Are
we the same number of movies out too?
Yeah, and they're both the seventh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So somehow it's okay, somehow it's not. So a slightly different question, Blaine, is what do you think that The Force Awakens brings that really sets it apart from A New Hope?
Well, I mean, the most obvious answer is we get these great new characters. Even in some of these, I mean, even though these new characters have their sort of parallels, like you can say Rey is the Luke character, or you can say Kylo Ren is the Darth Vader character, and they are in a sense, but they're also more than that. I'm sure we'll talk more, we'll dive more into these characters later on. But I mean, even if you think about Kylo Ren, probably my favorite character. Great, he's a great villain. You know, he gets to have his Darth Vader moment, his shot at redemption here in this movie, and he goes ahead and he kills somebody instead of saving them. So I think it is pushing in new directions, even as it sort of hangs on to these sort of narrative parallels. It's using them as a springboard, not just clinging on to them just to copycat and rake in more money on the same story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd agree. And I loved what they did with Kylo Ren too. I was saying to my wife that I think they almost are kind of doing with that character what we wanted them to do with Anakin in the prequels. See someone who is strong but conflicted and kind of unpredictable. And so it's really cool to see that type of character work out better than the Hayden Christensen's Anakin did.
When I was talking to my wife too, apparently we all have great conversations with our wives.
That should be a podcast.
Yeah, that should be. Great conversations with wives about movies. Which is why I have her on the show. I remember one of the things I kind of said tongue in cheek wise, trying to parrot that Batman phrase where it was like, you know, Kylo Ren was the Anakin we deserved, not the one that we got or whatever. And it seemed so obvious. It was like, it's like J.J. Abrams, was kind of like, or and Lawrence Kasdan, I guess, were like, we could do Anakin way better if someone would have told us we had this opportunity.
Yeah.
But Josh, I want to kind of hear from you on this too. I know that it's been a sore spot for you, especially with your review at Real World Theology, kind of pointing out how some of the criticisms levied against The Force Awakens are that it's too closely resembles A New Hope. Like, how would you kind of defend that? How would you defend that in general?
Yeah. Well, I think that it has a lot to do with maybe critics, or maybe they're not thinking that deeply enough, or maybe it's just it's an easy opening to exploit is its similarities. But I think that it's really missing the larger point that the mythos and the significance of Star Wars is something where you almost have to draw on some of that old mythos. It's one of the most culturally significant stories that has come out of the movies ever, and it's affected multiple generations of people that not only love stories, love movies, but also write stories. I remember JR saying on the A New Hope podcast or minisode, saying that, you know, this is an ideal movie. The original Star Wars is an ideal movie to talk about the hero's journey and to talk about just telling a good story. Mm-hmm. And so it's something that's so deeply ingrained in our culture now that it almost seems irresponsible that critics are missing out on like the greater point that when you're harkening back to something like that, I compared it to just, I was thinking about it because I was in the mid, like while I was working on that article, I was also, planning out like our post for the week, and we just had a top five on like Christmas Charles Dickens A Christmas Carol adaptations post for our top five. And I was thinking about like, well, you know, you never get that criticism leveled that when you make an adaptation of a famous novel that people are like, oh, it lacks surprise and it's not original, you know, to do a movie about Charles Dickens, which is another, it's a classic story of our culture and of Western culture in general. And so something like Star Wars is a lot more significant than something even like Rocky or Mad Max, which is another movie that sort of riffs on previous, previous material that we've lauded a ton this year. So I know that there was a couple people that made comparisons saying Mad Max was a better movie because it was more original and used the parts of Mad Max to make a better movie than Star Wars did, which decided to just do a remake. So I think it's missing some of that, the significance of what George Lucas was going for when he made the film. And also it kind of misses the fact that Josh Long, like you said, that was the tone that they were going for. They, Kathleen Kennedy and J.J. Abrams from the get-go have said that the first thing that they did when they sat down to sort of map out this movie and the story of this movie was, what do we want audiences to feel when they go to see this movie? And so it's like they set out to do to make it a Star Wars movie. And what better way to make it feel like a Star Wars movie than to sort of draw on the same archetypes, the same mythos, the same stories, that even some of the same beats, which is fine to be able to tell a good story. You know, we're not, our kids aren't going to get mad at us if we tell a story in a little bit of a different way. They're just, they're going to get mad if we try and pass off, you know, a different story as being the same story. And I feel like this is telling the same story, but in a new, interesting, and different way for a new generation of Star Wars fans. And for those of us who want to continue to love Star Wars until we croak.
Well, not only that, but especially after your review of it, Josh, I kind of started thinking a little bit, and I was like, these critics who are, you know, kind of putting it down for, like I said, being a remake, not, you know, kind of a sequel. I was like, these are the kind of guys that I would never want in my Sunday school class, because like when you're going through the Old Testament and it's like, all right, so Israel turns from God. God saves them anyway, and they're brought back into the fold. Guess what happens next? You know, in some basically similar way, they turn from God, something happens, they, you know, they're brought back into the fold. And it's the same story over and over. And I think about how we use phrases like, you know, nothing new under the sun. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that there are new characters and they're going through a lot of the same type of problems just shows me that they're in a world that has the same type of problems.
Yeah, and I'm kind of hoping that in the next couple sequels, they maybe delve into that a little bit more. Like, that can be part of the, you know, the story is about the cyclical nature of things. And, mm-hmm. and I think that'd be interesting.
Yeah. So, go ahead, Blaine.
So, yeah, I mean, I think it's really, all this is really interesting. And I think, like Josh Crabb said, it's really kind of unfortunate. It seems like some of these critics may not be thinking through this entirely, because they should know at this point that big budget, huge studios aren't in the business of making, of like narrative innovation or anything like that. Like, they mm-hmm. bank on making stories that are all basically the same. I mean, mm-hmm. point to a movie, and Josh Long, you can probably testify to some of this being a, mm-hmm. being a filmmaker working with independent studios. Like, The Force Awakens is made by Walt Disney Studios, not like Annapurna. They're, you know, they're not going to come out here and do some sort of art house Star Wars film. They're not going to push the bounds of narrative storytelling. They're going to stick with continuity editing. They're going to use all the same sort of formal structures and storytelling techniques that have been used for generations and churn out a good story, right? And that's what they did. But I mean, you can't. I can't think of a big budget film that has just pushed those boundaries and done something completely new anytime in recent memory. Mm-hmm. That's just not what they do. And that's not a bad thing. I mean, that's what those studios do, and that's okay. And independent filmmakers do other things, and that's great too. But I feel like they're not treating the film fairly. And it I don't know. It just seems like Josh said, you want to be cool by not liking something that clearly a lot of people like.
Well, and that seems kind of silly, because they're doing exactly what they set out to do. They do it well. People are enjoying it. And I would never, especially on this show, argue that because something made a lot of money, that it was therefore good. But not liking something just because it has explosions in it, I think misses the point of story.
Yeah.
It says that story can only be told in a certain way. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a little shackling.
Yeah.
And when we talk about differences between A New Hope and The Force Awakens, I think there's some ideas that I think they actually took and they twisted a little bit. And I think, Blaine, you talked about this a little bit, especially with some of the characters. But, you know, Star Wars was always a series that I could appreciate, because when the originals were made, it seemed like it was made during a time when it was okay to make good guy versus bad guy films.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there wasn't really a lot of blurred lines.
It was black hats and white hats.
Yeah, it was, you know, dark side, light side,
mm-hmm.
you know. But now we've kind of brought the saga up to date. We've made it appeal to millennials, you know, the key demographic. In the next one,
they're going to speak all in emoticons.
That's like right.
The whole script will be emoticons.
it'll have that movie making technique where they have like the text on the screen.
Yeah. Where they're like House of Cards.
Yeah, like House of Cards. So we have complications. You know, it seems so to me, and I'm kind of tossing this out there for someone to either tell me I'm wrong or kind of affirm me. But so Josh Crabb. Did The Force Awakens successfully blur the lines between light and dark for you? And if it did, kind of how did it do it?
I still don't think that it did maybe as much as people wanted to. I think that it did some really interesting things with Kylo Ren. I feel like that's the biggest change. Because I don't think that there was a significant part of the movie where, Rey was tempted by the dark side.
Yeah.
This was more to kind of fit the idea of The Force Awakens. Like, this movie is more of like the awakening of the Force in Rey. And so, that's what I kind of felt like when, Supreme Leader Snoke, says, you know, that I felt, there's been an awakening. Can you feel it? That it's sort of like an inspirational message to Kylo Ren, while at the same time sort of leveling with the truth that the light side is rising up again after they, you know, what we learn is that, you know, they had essentially beaten back the light again when Kylo Ren, decided to take out the Jedi Order and kill everybody except for Luke, as far as we know. So we don't know anything, and we'll probably get into that a little bit more maybe later. I promise I won't talk about that right now. but I feel like they did a lot of more interesting things with Kylo Ren, because when you think of Darth Vader, you think of bad guys in general, you think that you get that black hat that's just the sinister, menacing guy, and that's how the movie starts. It starts like the same way, you know, Kylo Ren makes his way down that ramp just the same way that Darth Vader came through the door of the blockade runner,
mm-hmm.
and just you're sort of introduced to the dark villain. But they do some very, very interesting things with him as far as his motivations and who he is. And again, it's going back to the Josh, what you said. I can say Josh, not Josh Long, because I'm not talking to myself.
Context clues.
You said that he's like Anakin, and I feel maybe that's the biggest thing, is it's almost like the hybrid of the prequels and the originals, in that you get sort of the complicated villain of the prequel trilogy, you know, the hero villain kind of character, and you get the original, which has the triumph, the adventure, the not politics, all the stuff from the originals that made you happy. And you're sort of blending those two things together. So it's kind of an update, but not as much maybe as people are making it out to be, as like a blurring of the lines. I really still think they're in this movie, there are villains and they are heroes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not something... I honestly don't think anybody was hoping for that. You know, I mean, we've had conversations in the past how people are seeming to turn and, you know, liking Captain America so much because Captain America's the good guy.
Yeah, he just does the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, I think that people long for that, but there's also the part of us that wants Batman.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like, we want the complicated hero that has a dark side, or, you know, we want the villain that has a little bit more backstory. And I think that's what they did. That was their update, is like giving the villain some sort of deeper motivations or motives, and sort of mashing together the emotional side of Darth Vader that we saw little bits and pieces of in The Empire Strikes Back, and then more so in Return of the Jedi. And we get that in Kylo Ren, a more complicated character, a powerful character, but a conflicted, petulant, sort of unstable bad guy. So
I would say, and while I agree with all that, and I think he would be the easy one to point to, what I would be interested in and Josh Long or Blaine, I guess I would love for you to one of you guys to run with this. But when I think of my own question, obviously, I think about Finn,
mm-hmm.
and Finn was a former stormtrooper mm-hmm. who's going through this wrestling of like identity crisis. How did that former stormtrooper backstory add complexity to The Force Awakens?
Well, I mean, it's one of the first times we've gotten to see one of these stormtroopers is not just sort of a faceless character, and we've really gotten to know them.
Mm-hmm.
And you also get this really interesting backstory on Finn. There's one of the new canon books is called Before the Awakening. And we see that even from the very beginning, Finn is just kind of a conflicted character. He doesn't feel right about serving the First Order. He's more sensitive and more tender than everyone else, and it continually catches the eye of Captain Phasma. So I think doing that and having that character that is a traitor. Which is what one of the other stormtroopers calls him,
mm-hmm.
Or maybe Ren himself calls him that. I think that's a really interesting thing to do. So maybe you do have. I would agree with Josh Crabb. I don't know that you have blurring the lines between good and evil, but you do have some more complexity there than maybe you've had in the past. Mm-hmm. Even the fact with Kylo Ren that he's not a Sith, I think, mm-hmm. is pretty significant.
Mm-hmm.
As something to nerd out about. Go ahead.
Oh, no, the Sith are gone. All right. Sorry. Okay, I'll stop. I'm not gonna.
Okay. Well, let me take this a step further then, because I really like what you guys are saying. But is it possible that Star Wars is hitting on an unintentional truth? And I don't think I'm digging too deep for this, but it seems like. One, something that makes these stories so compelling is that the light side is almost always the underdog.
Mm-hmm.
And that even when the light wins, it's still the underdog, even though we're rooting for it the entire time. You know, there's questions that I'm hoping that we'll get a chance to answer at some point about, Jedi set us up and said, the Empire's over. Your light has overcome darkness. We are so glad, and everyone can dance with Ewoks now. But now, 30 years later, like, the only Jedi we have is, like, hiding. Mm. Almost no one knows how to use the Force. A few people are doing what would be considered good. I don't want it to be too much of a leading question, but am I the only one who kind of sees, like, this paralleling real life?
Yeah. I think that's an interesting way to approach it is from the writing standpoint, for them to kind of explode the idea of happily ever after.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the way you do a sequel, because otherwise it becomes very uninteresting unless... I guess I shouldn't necessarily say that. There could be a way that you could have done something where it's our perfect ideal world and suddenly evil starts to bubble up. But either way, you need that conflict mm-hmm. between good and evil. And I think... when we see, I think the Star Wars franchise in general is one that's been really good about showing sort of the allure of the dark side and the allure of the evil. It talks a lot about like the power and all that kind of thing. And so I think that makes it a very, very multi-leveled view of good and evil. And I think that goes kind of back to what we were talking earlier about blurring the lines, is while there may be these characters that themselves are between the two extremes, I think it's always clear that there is a good side and there is a bad side. There's light and dark, mm-hmm. and those, regardless of where people may float between them, those are kind of moral absolutes that are there, mm-hmm. which is interesting to see a movie that espouses pretty strict moral absolutes. But yeah, so I like what they're doing with that. I like the idea of just doubling down on these powerful forces of evil that are enticing and that are menacing at the same time. I like it.
It's way easier to be dark.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, and that's I think one of the reasons that we all like the Kylo Ren character so much is because we can it's easy for us to put ourselves in those shoes a little bit. And I like the fact that he's both petulant, as someone else was describing him earlier, but that he's also still menacing.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you even think about it from like a cultural narrative standpoint, you know, something like, you know, Return of the Jedi ends, you know, happily ever after and Dancing with Ewoks, something that I wish I could put on my bucket list for my life.
I mean, you can, but you're going to be disappointed.
I could. It's just never going to be crossed off unless I can meet Warwick Davis someday.
That's good enough.
Yeah. So anyways, but, you know, you think about like the end of World War One. The Germans are defeated. Happy are us. We signed the Treaty of Versailles. And then, you know, a couple decades later, we end up fighting the same enemy again, who is now even more bitter and angry at the world for, you know, bringing them down and basically causing their economy to crash into the ground. So from a like historical standpoint and a cultural narrative standpoint, and even like an imagery standpoint when it comes to Star Wars, you know, the obvious parallels being, you know, the sort of the Imperial German imagery that's both in the original trilogy and in this one, which is, you know, they decided to bring in the red color to make it even look more like the Nazis in this time around.
What?
So, you know, you get this idea that the bad guys are never really dead or gone, because when peace is hashed out, and even some of the backstory that's been released since The Force Awakens, as far as like what happened with a galaxy far, far away after Return of the Jedi, shows that there was a peace, but it was a tenuous peace, and it led to conflict and more politics, and now the world is sort of the galaxy is sort of fractured again. And so I think it hits on this idea that we tend maybe not to think of in our stories, is like what comes after the story is done. That's an interesting, more realistic, or maybe temporal way to tell a story. You know, a lot of times when we get the happy ending, it's because, you know, we're thinking about like, from a biblical standpoint, we're thinking about, you know, the end of the world and God coming and making everything right and justice prevailing and all this other stuff. And that's perfectly a great story to tell as well. But there's also more to tell, because we have one foot in this world and one foot in another world. So I think that's really interesting too, that there's this, they're touching on something that maybe fits a little bit more of what history has taught us about a happy ending or the end of a war, I guess.
Actually, I think that gets me thinking, Josh, about one of the things I noticed about this film. One of my favorite interactions, and I wish I could quote it verbatim. If I'd maybe seen it four times, I probably could have. But there's this conversation between Han and Leia where, you know, Han says something like, "Oh, I went back to doing the only thing I was ever good at."
Yeah.
And Leia kind of was like, "Well, we all did, or we both did." And that to me is very, we just kind of accept it watching this movie. But I think it's another one of those things where Star Wars says these things very nonchalantly, and when I think about them, I'm like, wow, that's so poignant.
Yeah.
To what I think happens culturally and personally, because what I saw happen was people confronted with the truth. In this case, like, you know, Han being the Force is real, you know, this is real, all of it, blah blah blah, you know, the almost tear inducing kind of spiel. He was confronted with that. And despite that, despite having the truth, despite that revelation, it was still easier for him to go back to something that was comfortable, his old way of life, which, I mean, I think describes basically every Christian that I've ever met. I mean, to some degree or another. The bad thing is what it does is it kind of rolls through all the characters in this film. I feel all of them go back to something that's more comfortable. And we get like what happened in that 30 years, you know, and we see like, why didn't Leia do this? Or why didn't she train to become a Jedi? Well, she went back to something more comfortable. Han went back to something more comfortable, and it created division. Even though everyone was happy, people were dancing with Ewoks, they were crossing things off their bucket list. And But I noticed like everyone is running from something, even though they kind of, not everyone, but lots of people are running for something. I mean, even nuanced enough to say that Rey's actually running from her future, like actively running from opportunity. You know, Han is running from Leia. Kylo is running from the light. And his father, you know, to a certain degree, Luke is running from his failures. And we've already said, you know, Finn, when it wasn't, I think, obvious enough, he has this conversation with Maz, and she's like, I know the eyes of someone who's running, you know, and he's just running to run. And it's just one of those wacky things where I'm like, did Star Wars mean to do that? Does Star Wars mean to be so insightful about like human nature? Did anything else strike you guys?
Except for Poe, you know, he's the only cool guy. He's just too cool for school, man.
Well, I'll say this about Poe. I was trying to see if I could make Poe fit that too when I was kind of going through it. And I said, well, technically he is starting to run at the beginning of the film.
But then he gets caught.
But then he turns and fights. But then he runs again to get out of the Star Destroyer. That thing has a different name now. So he's running again. I don't know what happens. But then he comes back and fights. And it's actually, I don't get too much away, but like, I think it's one of the reasons I like Poe, because he's one of the few people who sees running as the answer. Running is only a means to an end. It's strategic.
Yeah, I felt like he was more of like the Princess Leia character of this movie, more of like the fully formed person who's already good and knows like what he wants to do and what his mission is. So
what has to be
right. I didn't see that. Right.
And is willing to do whatever it takes to do it.
Yeah. Right. And he gets captured. So that's the same thing too.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things I'm really interested in, you were talking about looking at Star Wars, you know, and some of this stuff from a cultural perspective. There's actually a lot of scholarship out there on Star Wars that looks at it as a Cold War narrative. And it's really interesting just looking at how, you know, Star Wars, and I'm talking about 4, 5, and 6, you know, kind of show what we were afraid of, in, you know, during the Cold War era and the late 70s and early 80s. And I think I'm really interested personally in how we're reappropriating a lot of Cold War narratives now and what that might say about what we're fearing. And I think, you know, when you've got a lot of this rhetoric going around about ISIS and Islam and all of this stuff, we're very afraid of these enemies that are very hard to get at, that go into hiding and that you can't really weed out. And it's interesting that we see that happening with the First Order, right? The Empire is sort of defeated or kind of defeated, and then they go into hiding and now they're reemerging. And I think it'll be interesting years from now to see what we look back, you know, as we look back on The Force Awakens and see kind of what it says about where we're at as a society now.
Yeah. And I thought it was interesting too, that the, this can't be accidental, that Supreme Leader Snoke gets that title of Supreme Leader, which is both what, they call, in South Korea, North Korea. I can't think of his name right now,
Kim Jong-un.
Yeah. Kim Jong-un.
Is it Un now?
Yeah. He goes by the Supreme Leader. And then, in Iran, they have the president, but then they have, it's essentially the same thing as the Ayatollah. He's referred to as the Supreme Leader as well. So I feel like two of our biggest obvious enemies in the U.S. right now both use that term for their leader. That can't be a mistake.
This film is going to be so popular in Iran.
They're going to love it.
They're going to love it.
They're not going to see it, probably.
Yeah, it's going to be loud. Actually, I think it's really funny because when they referred to him as Supreme Leader, I was like, that's so comical. Mm-hmm. Like, who would actually call someone Supreme? You know, I had like one of those like Homer moments or something. I kind of want to, we'll have a chance for a final moments or a final thoughts, but I kind of wanted to steer us towards being done or wrapping up. So with that in mind, I want to kind of give a chance. We've talked about lots of things we've liked in general, and we all seem very positive on the film and are glad that it was made, but what could it have done better? And I'll start with you, Blaine. What could this film have done better? Or as we say, what was kind of like something that made you say, come on?
Yeah, so my come on moment, we've talked about this a lot in our sort of little group, is that moment where R2-D2 just wakes up at the right time. And I know there's going to be an explanation for that. You know, probably a line or two thrown into episode 8 where it'll address it. But it's just, it's a little cheap. Didn't ruin the film for me. I've seen it 4 times. I'm going to see it more. But when that happens, I'm just kind of like, oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
And I know there are a few more moments like that. For some reason, that one, I'm just like, R2, you couldn't have done that a little bit earlier.
Well, I mean, you know, R2 is getting really old.
Yeah.
And so he's kind of like grandpa waking up during the football game now. He's like, what? Did someone score a touchdown?
Here's a map.
You looking for this?
All right. Josh Long.
I don't know if there was one moment in the film that I thought, I don't like that. I knew that at some point we were going to have to see Han Solo run in this movie. And I was like, Harrison Ford is 73 years old. He can't run. Don't make him run. And of course they did it as little as possible, but there was one moment when he's trying to hurry up away from the, whatever the creatures are on the
Raptors.
The Raptors. And it's like, he's never getting away from that. So there was that. That wasn't a big problem. Then I think I try not to be too hard on this because it's pervasive in films nowadays, especially in blockbusters, but I'm not crazy about some of the CG, particularly in fully CG characters. So the one, is it Maz?
Maz.
That I don't mind as much, but I don't like that they made Snoke into a yeah, because that's got to be your most menacing bad guy for the next two movies, and I feel like they're never going to be able to make that character, give that character the kind of evil, the kind of lack of humanity that a person can bring to a part.
Can I push back a little bit?
Sure.
So my instinct is to agree with you. And I would agree with you if there wasn't a very specific example that proved that idea wrong to me.
That being Gollum?
No, actually it wasn't even Gollum, because Gollum still...
Also, I mean, Andy Serkis.
Like, yeah, it was still Andy Serkis. But it was actually Andy Serkis... It's still Andy Serkis theme, because it's Andy Serkis's work in Planet of the Apes.
Which I haven't seen.
So the Dawn of the Planet of the Apes? Let's see. Rise, Dawn. Yeah, I think Dawn of the Planet of the Apes... the most recent one, the animation and the character work by Serkis and the other people who do those characters is so incredible that one, like, I was fully on board with, like, why can't these people win an Oscar? Or when is there going to be a category if you're not going to let them be nominated for their work as these characters? Because at no time in Dawn did I not, even though they're basically completely animated characters, did I think the apes were not real, based on facial expressions, movements, you know, like there's some incredible acting going on. And all we got to see was a hologram in this one. But since Andy Serkis is playing that character, and like you mentioned Gollum, and what I would say was, you know, the perfection of Gollum, which was in the Dawn of the Apes, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. I have hope that whatever is going to happen over the next year and a half, or if we don't get to see him fully in the next one in whatever, 4 years from now, technology plus Andy Serkis's acting skill is going to make that okay. If it doesn't, then I'm completely with you, because that wouldn't be my first instinct. Because I think the easiest thing and the safest thing to do, and probably the best thing, is to make it real.
Yeah. The other part of it that seems a little bit risky, too, is that Abrams is only directing this one, so he's kind of leaving this in the hands of other directors. And as we get into the following ones, I get less confident in the director.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember the guy who's doing the third one, but he...
Was it Colin Trevorrow?
I think it is. It's whoever did Jurassic World, which I also didn't see. And I don't know. That has me worried.
Hey, just because the story in Jurassic World was terrible doesn't mean the directing was awful, necessarily. No, but that is a very... this is me making We Get It motions that podcast people can't see. Wait, so who hasn't gone yet? Josh Crabb.
Yeah, I haven't gone yet, have I? Yeah, I think that my biggest come on was sort of the whole, I know that it needed to be sort of like the glue between the opening sort of act and the next act is the whole Rathtar scene, with those sort of like spinning octopus, like rancors out of the sand sort of look to them. I mean, they even had the throwback where it burps and the boot comes out, you know? And so it's it was the same burp as the Sarlacc. So, you know, that was kind of my come on just because it felt like the least Star Warsy thing.
Well, it felt like the most prequel-y thing, right?
Well, yeah, or it even felt a little bit more like sci-fi adventure-y kind of, you know, like it smacked a little bit too much of like it didn't fit. Like it can't be three stupid monsters. Like it needs to be something as like significant as like the Rancor, you know, just something big and menacing and scary. And those things weren't scary. They were just like, you know, they were like just hallway monsters, and it just wasn't that scary, you know.
Yeah, on the one hand, I think I initially didn't like it when I was watching it, and then I thought, well, there was definitely a creature feature element of Star Wars. You've got the trash compactor, you've got the Wampas, you've got the Sarlacc, you got the Rancor. Yeah. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff in there, so I don't mind that aspect of it, but I think I'm with you that I didn't really love the way they looked. They were not that interesting to me. And again, the CG thing, they seemed, I think, less scary than they could have been if they had done them a different way.
Or been played by Andy Serkis.
Maybe so. That's what they were lacking.
Oh, man. Okay. So for me, there wasn't really, well, I'm going to mention this kind of a general specific moment, but overall, it was like when I came out of the theater, and it was the same problems I had with A New Hope. I was like, there were too many plot holes, and there were way too many conveniences.
Hmm.
Like, how convenient is it that you blow up a giant weapon like 2 seconds before the giant weapon fires? Like, you know, I don't know. And lots of like R2 coming on, like, so it wasn't necessarily any specific one of those. It's just that there were so many.
Mm.
But like I said, that would be my same come on with A New Hope upon rewatching that. Fortunately, the movie is so entertaining and engaging that you don't really think about them until you forgive it. Because like I said, they're keeping the story simple. Mm-hmm. You can make it overly complicated and try to, you know, every single thing, but whatever. So I'll say that besides the things that I can forgive, I would probably agree with J.R. Forresteros. I think it was either in his review or on Facebook, he commented like one of his only problems with The Force Awakens were there were like two or three stare down scenes where people were just looking at each other. Like, I guess like internally figuring something out that just took a little too long. And, you know, one of them was when kind of Rey has her back against that cannon in the lightsaber fight with Kylo Ren. And she's like remembering the Force. And she's like, oh, yeah, the Force. And then becomes like awesome. And it just took a little too long, that the kind of staring scene. And even when her and Kylo are like trying to read each other's minds, I feel like the intensity of the stares back and forth, like I think we could have picked up on that without. And I just seemed kind of off for some reason.
Hmm.
Like I said, I understand why they did it. Just, I don't know. It didn't work for me. And then I think the biggest stare down that was really a problem for me was like, I think right now, like Rey is still holding Luke's lightsaber out to him and Luke's just sitting there staring at her. Like what?
Funny. I love that moment up until I'm not crazy until about the
yeah the panoramic yeah kind of the fly around or whatever.
That seemed a little. I don't know if it because I think that shot didn't work for me because we were so into the emotion of that moment, and I love seeing Luke turn around and he just looked super cool and everything, and it was like, oh, this is big, but then it suddenly cut out, and I think the distance somehow lost a lot of the emotion that was invested in that moment. So I kind of don't love the very last shot of the film.
Yeah. It's like, I wanted the last shot of film to be one of those two shots.
Mm-hmm.
Not both of those shots.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, like I said, it feels like I'm like most things that I really enjoy, I feel like I'm nitpicking to find
something. Sure, totally.
But so again, we switch gears to the positives, which I guess I'll let Josh Crabb go first because he'll go ahead and get everyone's favorite moments by just recounting the movie to us, and we'll be done.
That's not fair.
It's totally fair, Josh.
Okay. All right. It's perfectly fair. Okay. Well, I'll be specific. How about I'll pick one moment. And this was from the second viewing. Cause like I said, that first viewing was more of just taking it all in, not really able to truly enjoy everything in there. But you know, I'm going to steal the moment where probably consistently at every showing I saw, the most people laughed and had a good time was when Finn gives BB-8 the thumbs up and BB-8 returns the thumbs up the flamethrower thumbs up
or with the lighter
thumbs up. That is such a great moment and just cemented BB-8 as everyone's favorite character, right? Like, because it's just like that was great. So good.
All right. Josh Long.
We're saying favorite moments?
Favorite moment. Or favorite idea, character. Just what did you like about this film the most? The fact that it wasn't the prequels.
That was a sigh of relief. You know what, actually, I'll say I think my favorite part of it, I've already said I love that last moment when we see Luke, but I actually loved Rey's vision flashback thing.
Okay.
I really liked the way that they did that. I thought it was visually interesting. Cool. There were a lot of cool callbacks to like the hallway from Empire Strikes Back, and I've read stuff that said, and I didn't pick it up in actually watching it, but maybe some of you did who have seen it multiple times. But I guess we hear both Obi-Wan Kenobi and Yoda's voices during that sequence, kind of layered in the background somewhere.
Yeah,
which is I think a super cool thing to do. Yeah. I feel like I want to see more stuff like that done with the Star Wars universe because built into it is this mysticism and this sort of supernatural world. Granted, they all play with the stuff of the Force and that's cool and all, but I do like seeing these kind of unexplainable things that happen a lot like Luke Skywalker's vision in the cave in Dagobah.
Gosh, that scene was just so cool. I was trying to think of, I was reading like the breakdown of all the things that like happened in that scene. Mm-hmm. And I missed most of it. Yeah. I didn't pick up on half of it.
Yeah. Which is another reason I'm excited to see it again.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll make sure there's a breakdown of that I'll make sure is in the show notes too. So you can see all the cool stuff. If we don't end up talking about it kind of in our second segment, and Blaine, favorite moment.
Yeah, before I give you my favorite moment, you mentioned Luke seeing Vader in the cave at Dagobah. Did anybody else notice? Maybe it's because I've seen it so many times now. I'm starting to be like, oh, and there's this and this. But there seems to be one shot that really that's another parallel that's really interesting. With that scene in Empire Strikes Back when Vader shows up in the cave at Dagobah, it seems like Kylo Ren's entrance in the in the trench, when he's fighting, or when he's going after Rey on Takadana, it's a very similar sort of appearance. It was really cool.
Yeah, I think it might be. I think you're right.
Anyways, that's not my favorite moment.
But it is just a remake, so
yeah, exactly. Just beat for beat, really. Everything else is really original, though. I mean, like Fast and Furious 7, totally different than all the others. okay. So, anyways, favorite moment. I love all of the time we spend with Rey on Jakku. I think there's a couple of reasons for that. I live in West Texas and it's a desert. And so I'm like, if Rey can be cool and live on a far off planet in a galaxy far, far away, and it's a desert, then maybe West Texas isn't that bad. I don't get to eat and, you know, live inside of a, you know, fallen down AT-AT. Which actually, that's one of my favorite shots is when she's, you know, she goes and sits outside and she's leaning up against the foot of that.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
Falling down AT-AT. But I also really like the part, which I know is not the smartest moment in the movie or anything like that, but when she's running away from the TIE fighters on Jakku with Finn, they're heading out of Nima outpost and they're trying to get on the ship. And, you know, she kind of makes this offhanded comment. Oh, that ship over there is garbage.
Yeah.
And then the one they're going to get on is blown up. And, you know, it's just kind of this one shot. And, you know, you got this panning camera and then it's the Millennium Falcon. Very cool.
This when the goosebumps happen.
Yeah. I mean, everybody, on the opening night for the first showing, everybody erupted and just started clapping when that happened.
Yeah.
Nice.
It's so interesting that on opening night, almost no one like cheered or clapped at anything.
No way.
But when I saw it the next night, apparently that was the night all the cheers and clappers came.
Okay.
And the gaspers.
Oh, yeah.
Because when it was like, you know, Kylo Ren's my son, and they were like, what? So that was the second night for me for some reason. I found it very odd. Well, I'll say this. And Blaine and Josh may already know this, but Poe Dameron is the best character in the entire world. I loved him from the first time he was on the screen. I love Oscar Isaac so much. Yeah. And I think it's so rare to me to see the coolest part of a trailer actually deliver in the movie. Like in a because usually in the trailer, if you see something, they're like, oh, that was the cool part.
Mm-hmm.
So in the trailer or the teaser, when it shows the X-Wings flying across the water, I remember being like, I am so ready to see Star Wars right this second.
Yeah, no kidding.
And then in the movie, that was just the beginning of the awesome.
Yeah.
When they have that, that kind of, left to right shot of Finn fighting on the ground, but like,
yes, Poe, that's brilliant.
Poe flies in and he destroys like all the TIE fighters and he's hitting targets on the ground and Finn's like, that's some pilot.
Yeah.
Oh gosh. That I was so excited for that scene when I watched it the second time, because I feel like I didn't really take it all in the first time, because the first time I watched it, I didn't realize it was going to go on for as long as it did.
Sure.
I didn't realize he was going to do like a loop-de-loop and then shoot another one and then hit the ground target and then, you know, fly back up and then chase and hit something else at a different angle. And so I kept like preparing myself to turn away or blink. And, but the second time I was just took it all in. I was like, this is amazing. Poe is the best.
I feel like I just enjoyed that in its fullness for the first time today when I saw it. And you know, it's done in that long take.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of those moments where Abrams is at his most, Spielberg-esque, because Spielberg does a really good job with long takes where he's got a bunch of different action going on in different places. And there's a ton to look at. Really cool. Sorry. I didn't mean to rob your,
No.
That's an awesome,
if anyone would like to talk about how awesome Poe is, now is the time to do it.
Yeah.
He was really mean to Domhnall Gleeson, though, by, you know, putting him with that robot and tempting him and all. Oh, wait, that's the other movie.
Oh, so. Yeah.
Nice.
Once, like I said, the idea that Domhnall Gleeson has been now in three of my more favorite films of the year, and Oscar Isaac's now been in two of them at least.
What was the third one? I saw Ex Machina.
Brooklyn.
Oh, I haven't seen Brooklyn yet. I've heard it's good.
Blaine loves Brooklyn.
Yeah?
We might be talking about that at some other point. Mm. So if you do one of those, you know, Pixar theories to all these characters, it comes up with a very interesting, like, how they got where they got, you know? but yeah, Josh Crabb, you were going to say something?
I was just going to say, I like the start of that, too, when they said the resistance is coming, and you see them, like, almost like they're kicking up water, but it's like kicking up dust of, like, the white hats riding into town.
Oh, yeah.
I just love that. And I know there wasn't a lot of it in this movie. I'm expecting it maybe more in the future, just getting back to the roots, the cinematic roots of, like, how, you know, it's like a space western and how they just ride into town. And it's like, oh no, it's the resistance. It's like the sheriff is here.
Yeah. It's funny. It didn't occur to me until that point in the movie too, that like, oh, we haven't seen the rebels yet, really.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, cool. Here they come at the perfect moment.
Hmm.
You know who has a really good cowboy hat we didn't get to see much of, if any? Constable Zuvio.
Constable Zuvio.
Not even in the movie. And he was an action figure.
Good grief. What are you doing, Disney?
Oh, wait, is this the guy that you were talking about in the chat room?
Yeah,
chat, and you were like, "Where was he?"
I'm still sad about it.
Okay, well, I don't know who that is, and right now I don't care. Because you know what? He wasn't in
just
the movie.
Just friend Blaine on Facebook. Is it still?
It's still your cover photo?
It's still his cover photo. It's Constable Zuvio.
Oh. Until I get him in a movie, I'm not taking it down.
All right. Well, then, Blaine, give me your final thoughts about the film.
Now where to start? Now that you're asking me that, I'm like, no. So it's fantastic. It leaves plenty of questions unanswered, and I think we'll probably talk about that in another episode, or however you're gonna break it up.
Yeah.
But I gave you some editing problems there.
No.
But it leaves plenty of things unresolved, and I actually think that's a really good thing. I mean, it's fun to speculate about what's going to happen here, what's going to happen there. But ultimately, the great thing about Star Wars movies is that they leave some mystery there. And that mystery is part of the, part of the joy of being a Star Wars fan is you get to go to other places like comics and novels. And now that Disney is in charge of all this, you can go to like BB-8 oranges in the grocery store. And I'm sure there's clues hidden everywhere. And I like to do all that stuff. It hit all of the right notes. It's not a perfect film. But the fact that it's been able to sustain multiple viewings for me, and I've been super excited about every time, there's never been a moment when I'm like, oh yeah, come on. And I continue to find new things and my enjoyment of it increases. I think that's an indication that, I'm not going to look like an idiot 10 years from now, like some of the people who were so excited about episode one.
But yeah, that YouTube clip of people like giving Phantom Menace rave reviews.
Yeah.
Well, I think
I
was going to say, I think it says a lot too, because knowing you, the conversation I had with Josh Long before the show started is similar to how I feel about you, where, both you guys tend to lean more towards smaller films, independent films, not antagonistic to, but not wildly crazy about blockbusters in general. And the fact that you're really enjoying this film, which, for all intents and purposes, is a blockbuster, I think kind of says something about its ability to kind of straddle that aisle. So,
yeah.
Josh Crabb, what you got, man? Final thoughts?
Well, I think maybe hitting on the spirit of some of the things that I've written about The Force Awakens and what we've said here is that the cultural significance of the story of Star Wars, not to, heighten it up so much that, I'm being like, this is the Bible of the United States stories, but, the significance of it and just the ability to successfully execute by multiple different parties, including Abrams and the story group and Kasdan and all these other people, that they were able to retell it and tell a new story. But also, I think one of the more significant things and something that we can't miss in all of this conversation, something that we've seen to have taken for granted since the movie came out, is the fact that we have a woman replacing Luke Skywalker.
Mm.
And we have an African-American taking like the Han Solo-esque part. Like two of the main protagonists are, in 1977, after George Lucas had screened it for some, the original Star Wars for some directors, one director kind of said after the film was over, so George, is the entire, is the entire galaxy populated by white people? And, I think that that's a significant shift. We saw maybe a little bit of it in the prequel trilogy, but I feel like this really was able to bring the Star Wars franchise into the 21st century and start telling stories that reflect our culture, but also are telling the same story. It's not like we've updated this story and, Rey is a conflicted good guy who, murders her, murders Finn at the end of the movie and kind of has a Batman-esque quality to her. But I think it's significant. We can't miss that this is a story that's being told that is going to continue to have relevance. And it also has updated it and made it, kind of fit more of like probably a little bit more of what even our culture was back then too.
Mm.
And appealing to an audience that maybe felt slighted or didn't have a character to latch onto 30, 40 years ago. And so I think that we can't miss that, and it's incredibly significant. And I have to give kudos that, you know, that Star Wars was able to do that and stick to their guns and not, you know, they didn't sexify Rey, you know, they didn't, you know, they didn't do anything that felt culturally or racially insulting to Finn, you know? So it's, I think that they've done something really significant. I mean, even their new white guy here was Guatemalan. So, you get all of this, and I think it's really significant. I think it's really cool to kind of see that. And I don't feel like, you know, I don't feel it's like, well, where's the white guy that I can, you know, like, 'cause I'm white, but you know, I don't think that at all. And I think it's really great. And,
well, I mean, I think if anything, it's a great chance for Disney to get some of the mud out of their eye, right? Having the Marvel franchise and the Black Widow fiasco. Now, there are definitely going to be Rey toys. There's definitely going to be something that, you know, young girls or any woman, I guess, can look to as a character that they like without just having to pick, you know, which of the white guys are they going to like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But as you said that, I did recognize something else too, and that was, as much as things change, they kind of sometimes always stay the same, because in the end, British people are always bad guys. You know?
They just can't catch a break. But you know what? It's because of that Stamp Act, you know? Yeah. They had it coming.
Yep.
It's, I mean, never can't
take
changed.
It back.
Yep. We're never going to let them come over and be good guys again.
No.
I did like what you were saying, Josh, though, because I had that same thought that, like, two of the coolest hero protagonists this year are Rey and Furiosa from Mad Max, mm-hmm. both of them women. Yeah. I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Do you want to take it any further, Josh?
As far as last thoughts, I'm glad I liked the movie as much as I did. Like I said before, I'm a little trepidatious about the coming ones, a little bit more so.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there was something good about this movie in that it showed us... I feel like it showed us that we're never going to get something that's exactly what the original Star Wars was.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I think this is coming very close in a lot of ways, but it's different and it's meant to be different. And I think a lot of us who have been Star Wars fans for a long time, in some realm of our minds, believe that something will come out that will make us feel the same way that Star Wars did, the original, you know, New mm-hmm. Hope. And I feel like halfway through this movie, I was like, nothing ever again is going to be that, but that's okay. And
yeah.
I don't know. I thought there was something good about this, that we could see a movie that's a great movie that is within the Star Wars universe, but is not exactly for us what A New Hope was. And we can maybe kind of let go that idealistic dream that something's going to come by that can be the exact same thing. Does that make sense?
No, it does. But I would ask you this. If you were saying that nothing can capture that original feeling in its entirety, I would totally agree. But would you concede that at least certain times during this film, you were just bathing in nostalgia? Like, there were some giddy feelings?
I'd say a little bit, although I think maybe I personally tend to fight against that a little bit too, because mm-hmm. I don't want to give... I'm hesitant to give a movie points on pure nostalgia.
Yeah.
Because I feel like that can turn into pandering a little bit. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things I was worried about going into the film, is definitely. It would just be a lot of, you knew somebody was going to say, I have a bad feeling about this.
Yeah.
And there's little things like that you know are going to end up in there. And I didn't want there to be too much of that. Because some people who were Star Trek fans had complained about that a little bit.
Yeah.
With this new Star Trek movies. What is it? You know, it's throwing stuff to the fans. And that happens a lot in remakes or mm-hmm. in reboots or things like that. But I think it still did a lot of the things that A New Hope did in the same way without being the same thing, if that mm-hmm. makes sense.
No, it does.
So you got some of the same excitement in the same way, even if the movie as a whole could never exactly reach this sort of standard. Because I think the standard in a lot of ways is something that we have created by it being part of our past, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Especially people that are our age, like probably... I don't know, 50 well, it's and
like,
younger.
It's like, you know, our parents are like, you know, music's never as good as it was when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And we're like, well, music was never as good as I was a kid. And then, you know, kids these days, I don't even know what they're listening to.
Yeah.
I'm going to put memes on Facebook about how the lyrics were way better. Than,
right.
And if you really think about it, it wasn't, you know.
Yeah, and I'm sure there will be... I'm sure there are going to be lots. I know there are kids nowadays who think that the prequels are better than the original ones
But we're still trying to kill all those kids,
so and we will get rid of them. but so yeah, I think it's good for us to recognize that there is an element of nostalgia and something that's just in us because of what the movie was for us as kids that we can't exactly get back. But at the same time, we can appreciate the things that we appreciated in that movie, in A New Hope, in this movie.
Yeah.
And I think that's good.
Well, I would say in general, basically, you know, I feel like we're mostly all on the same page. And to me, The Force Awakens was a fine addition to the Star Wars canon. And ultimately, I'm now super excited about the next one. Now I have to sit through and wait to see the next one. And I hate that feeling, and I love that feeling.
Yeah.
You know, it means it did exactly what it was supposed to do.
Yeah.
So, you know, goodbye, George Lucas. You know, don't let the door hit you where the good Lord split you. And I'm glad that you had nothing to do with this movie. And we put it in the hands of someone who really appreciates some of our older movies and has a great way of taking what we love about those films and mix it into something new. So... with that said, we're going to end this portion of the show by letting you know how you can follow or get a hold or continue the conversation with our guests. So, Josh Long, where can people follow your work or follow you or keep that conversation going should they want to do that?
I am the co-host of the podcast More Than One Lesson with Tyler Smith. I'm one of three rotating co-hosts. Which is a podcast where we take a new movie and an older movie and we talk about a theme and sort of how we can look at that theme from a Christian perspective. Mm-hmm. That show releases every Thursday and the regular episodes are every Thursday and every other episode is a mini-sode. No, I think I said that in a confusing way. Go to the website, you'll figure it out, morethanonelesson.com.
That's the best.
But so yeah, we have regular episodes, and then between the regular episodes, we've been doing something that we're calling a series we're calling the Best of Pictures, where we're talking about all of the Best Picture winners. So if you're interested in the Oscars, we're all the way back to what did we just do? I think we might have just done The Sting. No, we did Patton. So we're coming up on Midnight Cowboy. Ooh, I forgot about that. All right. So but yeah, so there's that More Than One Lesson. Then you can follow me on Twitter, the Josh Long. And I'm on Letterboxd as well, if people do that, the Josh Long.
Do I follow you on Letterboxd?
I don't know, maybe.
Oh my gosh.
We'll have to find out.
All right, well, one of you other people tell them I'm going to go follow Josh on Letterboxd. Blaine, how can people follow you, man?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at DEPT_of_tourism, because I like to make it really hard. I write stuff at Real World Theology. It's a really good place. You should check it out. I also write for Real Thinking sometimes, and when they're crazy enough to accept the stuff that I write, I do some stuff for Christ and Pop Culture. So you can find me there.
All right. I commend all those things to you. And Josh Crabb, how can people continue the conversation with you?
Hey, you can find me on Twitter at Hey, It's That Josh. No exclamation point, just Hey, It's That Josh. You can also find me on the Facebook for Movie Lovers, Letterboxd, my unofficial sponsor. You can also find me writing and talking and doing all that at Real World Theology. So you should go there if you haven't. If you listen to this podcast, then you can go read all of my articles on Star Wars and officially call me a dork. So go there. Officially, yeah.
Official
so
dork.
Before that, it's just I'm unofficially a dork.
Oof, that's a bad place to be.
Oh,
it
man.
Really is. It really is.
Well, you can follow me at Physification on Twitter. You can find all the stuff I do at Real World Theology. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. And as usual, we're so grateful for our guests who have taken the time to be here from all over the country. And make sure you follow them. You can find all the ways to get a hold of them at the site. I'll make sure that's in the show notes. Thanks to you guys for listening to the show. Thanks for making us part of your week. And until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. May the force be with you.
And also with you.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
Okay, let's get our nerd on.
All right.
I'm going to be on this like I'm a so Wrathar on a Glovian Death King.